1.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
We canceled twice.
His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
The plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Cancel the Cabal with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
Kudos for reading books. That's pretty good, Annie. Well, it's interesting. I first started out doing this in video in February 2013, and there was a young man that was on the network that I was on. He was just reading white papers and reading memorandums and reading stuff from government agencies, and I thought it was kind of weird, so I'm not quite doing that, but doing something similar. Welcome, everyone, to another Tuesday on Shaken Wake Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel the Cabal, and also SoFlo Radio and PSN Radio. Never really thought reading books would be of interest to anyone. But, well, I guess, unless everybody's telling me fibs, I'm going to continue on doing it. I'm going to continue on reading The Truth About Contagion, Exploring Theories of How Disease Spreads by Dr. Thomas Cowan. I think I'll go back about a half of a, maybe a full paragraph, to go back over voice radio. Oh, yeah. Actually, Native peoples did not contract disease immediately on contact with the Europeans. For example, fishermen and early explorers visited the northeastern waters along the Atlantic coast during the 15th and 16th centuries. Yet we have no historical commentary of the existence of disease or epidemics among the Aboriginal people during that time. According to Raymond Obam Sawin, in his report Historical and Scientific Perspectives of the Health of Canada's First Peoples, since the prime purpose of this early contact was to commercially exploit natural resources, any visible evidence of the physical weakness or sickness of the indigenous inhabitants would surely have excited some keen interest. Instead, these early reports marveled at the Native Americans' good health and robust constitution. Obum Sawin notes that the first recorded outbreaks of disease in Native Americans living in the Ottawa Valleys occurred between 1734 and 1741. Samuel de Champlain had established the first European settlement at Quebec on the St. Lawrence River over 100 years earlier in 1608, and it wasn't until the 1800s that smallpox, dysentery, typhus, yellow fever, tuberculosis, syphilis, and various other fevers became prevalent in the Aboriginal population. That's because their immune systems had been compromised by then. My opinion. By the mid-18th century, Native American life had succumbed to serious disruptions as a result of intensive trapping. The game populations had dwindled, seriously affecting the availability of food and skins to make clothing and footwear. During this period, sugar, white flour, coffee, tea, and alcohol arrived on trading ships, which the colonists traded with the Indians for furs. And there goes the immune system right there. The same pattern prevailed on the West Coast, where the salmon fisheries became depleted in the mid-1800s. These Northwest peoples spoke of disease boats or pestilence canoes. The Spanish and British seagoing vessels that arrived with increasing frequency, they brought smallpox, but also the foods that made them vulnerable to smallpox. An early 100-foot sailing cargo vessel could transport as much as 800,000 pounds of goods. Or maybe we should say bads, including blankets for the Native Americans. Tribal peoples largely depended upon the buffalo, who were not affected until the early 1870s, when the animals became depleted through exploitation and deliberate campaigns to kill off the herds upon which they depended. According to the Canadian government report, the transformation of Aboriginal people from the state of good health that had impressed travelers from Europe to one of ill health grew worse as sources of food and clothing from the land declined and traditional economies collapsed. It grew worse still as one mobile peoples were, as once mobile peoples were confined to small plots of land where resources and opportunities for natural sanitation were limited. It worsened yet again as long-standing norms, values, social systems, and spiritual practices were undermined or outlawed. Regarding the Plymouth colony, the Pilgrims were not the first Europeans in the area. European fishermen had been sailing off the New England coast with considerable Native American contact for much of the 16th and 17th centuries, and trading for beaver skins commenced in the early 1600s, prior to the arrival of the Pilgrims in 1620. In 1605, the Frenchman Samuel de Champlain made his extensive and detailed map of the area and the surrounding lands, showing the Patuxet village, site of the future town of Plymouth, as a thriving settlement. In 1617 and 1618, just prior to the arrival of the Mayflower, a mysterious epidemic wiped out up to 90% of the Indian population along the Massachusetts coast. History books blame the epidemic on smallpox, but a recent analysis has conducted that it may have been a disease called leptospirosis. Even today, leptospirosis kills almost 60,000 people per year. Leptospirosis is a blood infection similar to malaria, associated with various forms of
Spirochete bacteria. Other forms of spirochete parasites characterize syphilis, yaws, and Lyme disease. Humans encounter these spirochetes through animal urine or water and soil contaminated with animal urine, coming into contact with the eyes, mouth, nose, or cuts. The disease is associated with poor sanitation. Both wild and domestic animals can transmit leptospirosis through their urine and other fluids. Rodents are the most common vector, and the beaver is a rodent. Interesting. Beaver is a rodent. It lives in the water and eats wood. One important factor omitted from the discussions about Native American diseases is the disruption of the salt trade. The first European explorers in the New World did not come to the East Coast, but to Florida and the southern part of North America. During the 1540s, 80 years before the Pilgrims landed in Plymouth Rock, the explorer Hernando de Soto led the first European expedition deep into the territory of the modern-day United States. They traversed Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and possibly Arkansas, and they saw the Mississippi River. Some anthropologists have insisted that Native Americans did not consume salt, but De Soto received an abundance of good salt as a gift from the Native Americans, and he observed the production and trade of salt in the southeastern part of the country. In the lower Mississippi Valley, he met traveling Native American merchants selling salt. According to the De Soto records, lack of salt could lead to the most unfortunate death. Some of those whose constitutions must have demanded salt more than others died a most unusual death for lack of it. They were seized with a very slow fever, on the third or fourth day of which there was no one at 50 feet could endure the stench of their bodies, it being more offensive than that of the carcasses of dogs or cats. Thus, they perished without remedy, for they were ignorant as to what their malady might be or what could be done for them, since they had neither physicians nor medicines. And it is believed that they could have benefited from such had they possessed them, because of the amount of the moment they first felt the fever, their bodies were already in a state of decomposition. Indeed, from the chest down, their bellies and intestines were green as grass. The most important sources of salt were the salt springs that dotted northwest Louisiana, western Arkansas, and the Ohio River Valley. Archaeological remains in these areas indicate that the Native Americans evaporated the brine in shallow clay salt pans, most likely by adding hot rocks to the brackish water. They also retrieved salt from ashes of certain plants and from salt-impregnated sand. They sometimes gathered rock salt. Well-defined salt trails allowed the transport of salt to the east. Coastal Native Americans generally got their salt through the trade rather than the evaporation of seawater, as wood for fire making it sparse near ocean beaches, and the moist sea air is unconductive to evaporation. The salt traders did not belong to any tribal group but traveled along from tribe to tribe, carrying baskets of salt gathered from salt lakes, along with other goods. As Native American culture life crumbled in the face of the European invasion, the salt trade would have been an early victim of its disruption. Salt is critical for protection against parasites. We need the chloride in salt to make hydrochloric acid. Without salt, the stomach will not be sufficiently acidic to kill parasites. The point is that the so-called infectious disease that caused so much suffering did not arrive until after a period of disruption and nutritional decline. And fear and despair almost certainly played a role. When disease broke out in the village, the afflicted often found themselves abandoned by those still healthy. So they had no one to care for them. Unable to get water for themselves, they typically died of thirst. This may explain why the death rates during the outbreaks were so much higher for the Native Americans, typically 90%, than for Europeans, typically 30%. One disease blamed the Native American death was measles, considering it was a viral disease. But on February 16, 2016, the Federal Supreme Court of Germany made a historic ruling that there is no evidence for the existence of measles virus. The case grew out of a challenge by German biologist Stefan Lanka, who offered a sum of 100,000 euros to anyone who could supply proof that the measles virus existed. A young doctor, David Bardens, took up the challenge, providing Lanka with 6 studies as proof that the measles virus did indeed exist. When Lanka claimed that these studies did not meet the evidence needed to claim the prize, Bardens took him to court. The court sided with Bardens and ordered payment of the prize. But Lanka took the cases to the Supreme Court, where the judge decided in his favor and ordered the plaintiff to bear all the procedural costs. Lanka was able to show that these 6 studies misinterpreted ordinary constituents as cells, as part of the suspected measles virus. According to Lanka, the decades of consensus building processes may have created a model of a measles virus that doesn't actually exist. To this day, an actual structure that corresponds to this model has been found neither in a human nor an animal. With the results of the genetic test, all thesis of existing of measles virus has been scientifically disproved. The existence of a contagious measles virus justified the development of measles vaccines, which has earned the pharmaceutical industry billions of dollars over a 40-year period. But if such a microorganism does not exist, said Lanka, this raises the questions of what was actually injected into millions of German citizens over the past decades. According to the judgment of the Supreme Court, it may not have been a vaccine against measles. But what about measles parties? What about successful attempts by parents to infect their children with common childhood disease like measles, chickenpox, and mumps? And what about sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis, said to be a disease that the Europeans contracted from the Native Americans? The mystery of childhood illnesses and sexually transmitted diseases will be addressed in Chapter 7. We are Chapter 4, From AIDS to COVID. And I'm going to take a little 10-second break here and get something to drink before I continue. I know I shouldn't be drinking a soda, but I'm all out of unsweetened tea. And I'm all out of money, too, for the month. That reminds me. Please support all of the stations, if you can, with a donation. Chapter 4, From AIDS to COVID. To understand the story of coronavirus, it's instructive to go back to 1971. That was the year that President Nixon declared a war on cancer. The theory of the day was that viruses caused cancer, and the medical establishment vowed they would find a cure by 1975. Hundreds of millions of dollars flowed into the completely one-sided cancer research focused on wonder drug production. Of course, the war was a complete failure, but by the 1980s, NIH scientists were scrambling to obtain continued funding, and the CDC needed a major epidemic to justify its existence. Enter AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, said to be caused by HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. A deadly virus that made the jump from other primates to humans in West Central Africa in the early to mid 20th century. Some predicted that as an STD, AIDS would eventually spread through the whole population and kill us all. Between 1981 and 2006, almost $200 billion was invested in AIDS research, focused on the virus hypothesis and development of a toxic antiviral drug like AZT. Many books have carefully documented the case against the claim that a virus called HIV caused the disease called AIDS. Unfortunately, these careful arguments seem to make no difference to the man on the street, nor to scientists, for that matter. In essence, no matter what the evidence, 99% of the population, including most of the alternative medicine community, still believe in this myth. Let's look in the facts. Let's look at the facts. AIDS was not a disease new to the 1970s and early 80s. In fact, it is the same disease and condition caused by immunosuppressive drugs used to prevent people from rejecting organs, such as a heart or kidney, after a transplant. The only thing new about the disease was the appearance of the new type of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. AIDS is not a specific disease at all. It simply means a collapse of the cell-mediated immune system, known even in the 70s to have many diverse causes. With the collapse of the immune system, you see conditions like frequent infections, tuberculosis, mononucleosis, peripheral neuropathy, and Guillain-Barré syndrome, all of which have often come under the rubric of AIDS. The new part of the disease, Kaposi's sarcoma, has been definitely linked to the use of poppers, alkyl nitrite drugs, which are immune suppressive. This drug was used to relax the anal sphincter and facilitate anal intercourse. The vast majority of people who got Kaposi's sarcoma were gay men who used poppers, never people who actually acquired the virus from any other source. Once the use of poppers stopped in the gay community, so did Kaposi's sarcoma. In spite of 40 years of research, no one has isolated an HIV virus from any bodily fluid or a person suffered from AIDS. Not once. This is shocking for most people to hear, but cash awards are available for anyone who can show
with an electron microscope purified HIV virus isolation from anyone with AIDS. Up to this point, no one has collected these cash awards. No one has ever documented transmission of any purified HIV virus from one person or animal, or one animal to another, with any resultant sickness. Not once. In fact, the biggest study on AIDS ever carried out clearly showed that HIV is not transmissible through sexual contact. And finally, we will discuss in Chapter 5 the tests used to make a diagnosis of AIDS can never determine causation. It is simply a test looking for genetic material of unknown origin. Sounds like the PCR test. Since we have no proof of any virus or bacteria has ever caused any disease, the test is simply irrelevant for determining causation. When they test for AIDS, called a PCR test. Imagine that. Finds a higher level of genetic particles in the blood. It simply means that the person's condition is causing a lot of genetic deterioration from toxins, EMF poisoning, malnutrition, or stress, or all of them. That's my adding. The test can never determine the cause of an illness. If one first isolated, purified, and characterized the entire genome of a virus in question, then one could determine whether the snippet of genetic material you are looking for is unique for that virus in question. Absent during the purification, isolation, and characterization step, there is simply no way to say that the snippet you are looking at is either unique to that virus or even originated in that virus. Okie dokie. Right here at the first half hour here for, guess I do need to look for a pen and mark my spot before I forget. Yeah, I've already lost my spot. Oh, wait a minute. I think I got it. Okay. You're right here at the first break, everyone. So, I guess... I already played that song. Yeah, this... Annie likes this one, so I'll play this song. Be back in about 4.5 minutes, everyone.
Thank you. Oh, I wish I was in a land of cotton. Old times are not forgotten. Look away.
Thank you. You're fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
All right. Sorry about that. I started to get a sneeze right when I kind of go back on air. You're welcome, Annie. It's a good song. If you poison an organism with any type of toxin, that degrades your cells, which most poisons do, including EMF poisons, then more genetic material will be found in your blood, and the PCR test will pick this up. This means you are sick. This also applies to antibodies. The more poisoned you are, the more antibodies you tend to produce to protect yourself. This simple fact explains why all PCR and antibody tests, including those for HIV and the coronavirus, tend to show higher viral loads, which are not viruses, but genetic material. And to be more positive in sicker people. It doesn't mean that you have a viral infection. It means they are sick. This is why the package insert for PCR and the antibody test for both HIV and coronavirus say that they may get a false positive if the person has one of about 40 conditions. These include strep throat, viral infections, autoimmune disease, cancer, pregnancy or nursing, and in other words, any stress on the body provokes us to make more antibodies and have more degraded genetic material in our blood and other fluids. No surprise there. There is nothing in these tests that either proves viral causation or absent purification proves that the PCR snippet even came from a virus in question. Nothing. It is simply how it occurs. Since these facts are obviously and easily proven, how can they have escaped the scrutiny of a brilliant man and women who run our healthcare system and populate the ranks of virologists? Because they're all in on it too. That's why. They're profiting. Once our health authorities declared that the multifactorial condition called AIDS was caused by our virus, they needed to come up with a way to treat it. The pharmaceutical companies, in particular, Burroughs Wellcome, dusted off an old and very toxic drug called, well, it's just called AZT. I can't pronounce the medical word. Azithromycin, that's what it is, AZT, and remarketed it for use with AIDS patients. AZT is a nucleoside analog drug. It interferes with the production of DNA from the RNA supposedly contained in the HIV virus. The theory is that without the ability of the HIV virus to make copies of DNA, it can't grow, replicate, and cause infection and disease. In practice, not only did AZT show much of the toxicity associated with cancer chemotherapy drugs, many of which also interfere with some aspect of DNA replication, it was shown to be worse than worthless in preventing the progression of any asymptomatic to full-blown AIDS. What did I get right, Melissa and Mom? I've forgotten already. In the first trial of AZT on asymptomatic HIV-positive people, AZT was given to
877 people, while 872 received a placebo. As soon as the patient developed any AIDS symptoms, he or she, 15% were women, would be offered open-label AZT. The mortality rates were shocking. Over the 3 years of the trial, there were 79 AIDS-related deaths in the AZT group, but only 67 patients in the placebo group. So not only were you more likely to develop symptomatic AIDS, if you took AZT compared to doing nothing, you were also subjected to all the usual toxicity of taking a chemotherapy drug. Yeah, yes, they're all in on it. Adverse effects of AZT include nausea, vomiting, acid reflux, headache, sleep problems, and loss of appetite. Long-term adverse effects include anemia, neutropenia, low white blood cells, liver toxicity, cardiomyopathy, problems with the heart muscle, and myopathy, muscle weakness. There are many parallels. I have some of these. I have a lot of these symptoms. Just some of them anyways. Actually, I have one of the opposite. Low red blood cells, high white blood cells. That's what it was. But still, some of these other symptoms. Anyways, I think a lot of these diseases all go hand in hand. They just market it as something else. I don't know. There are many parallels. Well, it's probably all just poisoning, 4G poisoning, 3. All of the white noise from the electromagnetic, that's the word I was looking for, electromagnetic poisoning. There are many parallels to today's situation in which antiviral drugs actually increase the likelihood of having a bad outcome from this imaginary viral disease called coronavirus. In the wake of AIDS following other viral diseases, including hepatitis C, SARS, MERS, bird flu, swine flu, Ebola, and Zika, great sums were dedicated to finding viral causes, and one drug fits all cures are following a familiar playbook. Yeah, they're going by a playbook for a long, long time. This comes from, not sure where, but it's a little snippet. Inventing the risk of a disastrous epidemic, incriminating an exclusive pathogen, ignoring alternative toxic causes, manipulating epidemiology with non-verifiable numbers to maximize a false perception of an imminent catastrophe, the promising salvation of vaccines. This guarantees large financial returns. But how is it possible to achieve all of this? Simply by relying on the most powerful activator of human decision-making process, fear. Needless to say, researchers have yet to prove that a virus causes any of these conditions. Fast forward to November 2019, when authorities in China noticed that a group of people were getting sick in a new way. They noticed that many of the people who contracted this illness reported visiting a particular fish market in Wuhan, China. The symptoms were respiratory in nature, including dry cough. Of course, these symptoms are not altogether new, as people throughout history have suffered from a variety of respiratory diseases such as bronchitis, pneumonia, and asthma. Still, as the number of cases increased, authorities looked into the situation. There was a suspicion that a new disease had appeared, but naturally triggered a search for the cause. New disease. That should have been in parentheses, with a little joke afterwards, maybe. A little LOL. I don't know. Because the symptoms of the sick people resembled pneumonia, some of the original patients received antibiotics. This was done because of the recent postulates. Proving causation of an infectious disease states that if antibodies fail to resolve the symptoms, this constitutes presumptive evidence that, rather than direct evidence, that the pneumonia is caused by a virus. They don't give antibodies for viruses. Not from what I understand, because they don't work. Which obviously doesn't respond to antibiotics. Okay, that's what he just said. Since the patients didn't improve with antibiotic therapy, this triggered the hypothesis that the new type of pneumonia must be caused by a new or modified virus. New mystery killer. Come get your vaccine for it. That won't work. Let's consider our original ping pong ball example given in Chapter 1. The whole issue is that point resolves around whether the viral causation of this new set of symptoms can be proven. We want and should demand proof of causation, not a ping pong ball and a bucket of stones and ice cubes, a computer simulation, and an analysis of the virus, or the testimony of experts. We are betting our lives, our children, and the world economy, and much more on the weight of the evidence. We need rock-solid proof. We need to follow the Koch's or Rivers' postulates, which entail a simple line of reasoning that any rational human being can recognize as the way to prove infectious causation. In other words, here is what should have happened in early 2020. As soon as the Chinese medical authorities suspected an outbreak of a new and dangerous disease, they should have collected about 500 people with identical or at least nearly identical symptoms. Then they should have identified another group of equal size as matched controls. That is, people of a similar age, lifestyle, and background, also from Wuhan, who had no symptoms. Given the possible slow development of this illness, it would have been prudent to follow the 500 control people over at least a few months to make sure that none developed these new symptoms. The next step would be to do a thorough microbiological examination of the variety of fluids taken from these 1,000 subjects. At the minimum, this should have included blood, sputum, urine, and nasal swabs. The examinations should have included conventional light microscopy to look for bacteria, and electron microscopy to look for viruses. I'm not sure why that word's said. Once a novel bacteria or virus was found in all the sick people and none of the well people, the bacteria or viruses should have been meticulously isolated. But you can't. Isolated, purified, and cultured in a neutral medium, which is actually not possible for viruses since they grow only in other living cells. Viruses are poison. They don't grow. They're not alive. They only poison living cells and kill them. Of course, I think he's already gotten to that. Once this purification step was accomplished, the purified microbe should have been introduced into a test animal in a normal way that one suspected the microbe might be spreading. By airborne droplets not injected directly into the brain of the animal, as scientists like Pasteur did, to prove the contagious etiology of rabies, TB, or polio. Finally, a control group of test animals should have been subjected to the same attempts of contamination. In other words, if you were going to spray purified virus into the animal's nostrils to see whether they get sick, you need to spray pure saline into the nostrils of a control group of animals to make sure the animals are not getting sick, just because you are spraying stuff into their noses. Any sane and logical person would agree that this is what should have happened. Finally, if you were for some reason the medical authorities in China were unable to carry out such an investigation, they should have enlisted the help of the CDC and the evaluation organizations in Europe and Russia, or the World Health Organization, to make sure the investigations were done carefully, properly, and thoroughly. The amazing part of this story is only do we lack this kind of evidence for a viral cause of COVID-19. We also lack this kind of evidence for many viral epidemics we have faced during the last century, including polio, AIDS, SARS, Ebola, Zika, and hepatitis C. In fact, not a single part of this clear and simple proof has been attempted. Let's look then. I wonder what they used back in the late 60s, because I was always told that my cousin, I think she had, when she was younger, it seems like she had, it was either TB or hepatitis C. I think it might have been TB. And my parents took me to get tested, and I first had a positive test for TB, and then the second test was negative. I wonder what test they used back then. I surely hope it wasn't the PCR test. I don't really know when Dr. Kerry Mullis invented that. I guess I should have looked. But let's look then at what was done to prove the severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2, SARS-CoV-2, was the cause of this new set of symptoms. Four papers published in China are cited as proof that the new and novel coronavirus is a probable cause of this new disease. For an in-depth analysis of these papers, please refer to the presentation by Andrew Kaufman, MD, in which he dissects in more great detail the methods and conclusions of these seminal studies. To review these four studies, let's look again at Rivers' postulates for determining whether a particular virus causes a disease. Number one, the virus can be isolated from diseased host. Two, the virus can be cultivated in host cells. Proof number three, proof of filterability. The virus can be filtered from a medium that also contained bacteria. Number four, the filtered virus will produce a comparable disease when the cultivated virus is used to infect experimental animals. Number five, the virus can be re-isolated from the infected experimental animal. Number six, a specific immune response to the virus can be detected. None of these four studies met all six postulates. Of the four studies said to prove that the coronavirus caused this disease, not one of them satisfied the first three postulates, and none of them even addressed postulates four or five. One paper claimed to find an immune response, postulate six, by looking at antibody levels from the patient. The first two papers are honest enough to claim only an association of coronavirus and the disease. The third paper claims that the coronavirus is identified as a causative agent. The fourth paper from McMaster University falsely claims that the coronavirus is the causative agent of the disease and that the virus set in motion the pandemic, with no evidence to back up these statements. These papers never show that the people with COVID-19 had the same set of symptoms. They never purify any virus from the sick people. They never demonstrate the absence of the virus from well people. And they never show that the transmission of purified viruses can make well people sick. This is scientific fraud in the first order. It's interesting to look closely at how virologists work to prove something like causation by coronavirus. One example is a paper published in 2003 in Nature titled Koch's Postulates Fulfilled for SARS Virus. Researchers claim that severe acute respiratory syndrome is caused by a coronavirus. The title itself is misleading, if not dishonest, because the researchers satisfied neither Koch's nor Rivers' postulates. Here's what they did. First, they took respiratory secretions from some sick people. In other words, they took sputum from people with a cough. They centrifuged the sputum, which separates the cellular part where presumably the virus is residing in the cells, from the liquid part. They discarded the liquid part. This is what they referred to as purification. Then they took the centrifuged, unpurified sediment from sick people containing God knows what and inoculated that into monkey cells, monkey kidney cells, where we have to understand that if virologists want to, get enough virus to use experimentally, they must grow it in a biological medium, such as an animal, or at least cells from an animal. Unlike bacteria, which can be grown in petri dishes, viruses are not alive, and they can grow only in other living cells. For convenience, and because cancer cells' lines are immortal, they generally grow their viruses in cancer cells. However, in this case, they use kidney cells. This practice is fraught with obvious problems for proving it is the virus and not the kidney or cancer cells that are causing disease. When these viruses then get injected into test animals, also, it is well known that as part of their detoxification strategy, cells, especially cancer cells, produce particles called exosomes, which are identical to viruses. Mark my spot right here. Time for the second break, everyone. So. Okay, let's see. I think a couple of short songs, maybe. Yeah, going to add up to about a little over 5 minutes, everyone. So be right back. Make a coffee or a tea or a sandwich.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. I had to try to find my mouse here for a few seconds. I've got three screens, and it moves all between all three of them, so sometimes it can be a chore trying to find it. Jeez, looking at all the pages in this book, I'm about one-third of the way through the book already, so this is going to be a lot quicker book than what the last one was, that's for sure. And again, all stations are listener supported, so please donate if you can. Again, the researchers took unpurified sediment from the nasal mucus of sick people and grew that in viral cells until they got a sufficient quantity of cellular material to work with. Then they centrifuged this mess again, not even attempting to purify any virus from the mixture. Finally, they took this witch's brew of snot, sediment, kidney cells, and who knows what else, and injected it into two monkeys. They didn't do a control group by injecting saline into other monkeys, or injecting viral cells into monkeys, or even injecting a liquid supernatant from this centrifuged material into monkeys. They just injected this cellular debris-laden goop. One monkey developed pneumonia, and the other appeared to have respiratory symptoms, possibly related to a lower respiratory disease. That claim, the researchers, is proof for the coronavirus can cause disease. Yeah, well, I have to look for it if I don't know where it's at, Annie. So, yes, it hides. To be fair, in a related study, researchers did the exact same procedure except to make it more reflective of how the new virus actually spreads. They took unpurified lung cancer grown centrifuged snot, and again without any controls, squirted it down the throats and into the lungs of hamsters. Some, but not all, of the hamsters got pneumonia, and some died. We have no idea what would have happened if they had squirted plain lung cancer cells into the lungs of these hamsters, but probably not anything good, and even more perplexing, some of the hamsters didn't even get sick at all, which certainly doesn't square with the deadly contagious virus theory. In short, no study has proven that coronavirus, or indeed any virus, is contagious, nor has any study proven anything except that virologists are dangerous, misguided group of people, and that hamster and monkey rights people are not doing their jobs. This story is analogous to proving that the ping pong ball can knock down walls by throwing a bucket of rocks and ice cubes containing a single ball at a small wall and showing that this does knock down the wall. These proofs make no sense and proving nothing. And yet the whole edifice of coronavirus causation rests on these bogus studies. In chapter 5, we will deconstruct the equality bogus testing now used to prove what passes for supportive evidence of viral causation. Stay with us, the ride gets more interesting as we go. What was that cartoon character from the 60s or 70s that said, "And away we go"? I don't remember who that was now. Maybe somebody will remember. I missed a page, I think. I did. Chapter 5, Testing Scam.
In a series of recent articles published in local and national news media, as well as in various scientific papers, some of the world's leading medical doctors and immunologists have made surprisingly honest and shocking statements about coronavirus testing. The test is used, it's called a PCR test. The PCR means polymerase chain reaction. Here are some samples of these statements. We did not perform tests for detecting infectious virus in the blood. This statement came from a paper in which the authors allege they had discovered the novel coronavirus in patients suffering from COVID-19. There is no way to tell whether the RNA being used in the new coronavirus PCR test is found in these particles seen under the electron microscope. There is no connection between the test and the particles, and no proof that the particles are viral. Ironically, this statement does not come from a paper attempting to debunk the coronavirus causation of COVID-19. It comes from a paper that adamantly espouses this connection, but which claims that more research is needed to understand the interesting intricacies of this new virus. Or this from the head of Marin County Public Health Department, charged from making public health policy for Marin County, California. The PCR test means you either are infected with the novel coronavirus or you are not infected with the virus. Such a statement is akin to going to the refrigerator store to purchase a new refrigerator and asking the salesman about a new model in the showroom. He says to you, it's a new and interesting model. It will either keep the food cool or it won't. Most people would not choose to elevate this person to head of refrigeration for Marin County. An NBC News feed reported on certain puzzling results. Sailors who test positive, then negative, and positive for COVID-19 using the PCR test. This should not happen if a test is any good, a CDC representative stated. Detection of viral RNA does not necessarily mean that infectious virus is present. White men speak with forked tongue. That's what I'm reading. According to one infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, it's possible that people could shed remnants of the virus for some period of time. This doesn't mean anything is wrong with them or that they are contagious. More doublespeak. These sentiments are all referring to the test used to claim that a person is infected and can spread the disease. When asked about these statements, the head of the lab that specializes in testing for infectious disease told us, a positive PCR test means you have active disease or you are a carrier and don't have active disease. When we asked how to distinguish between those who are active disease and those who are carriers, she confidently replied, those with active disease are sick and carriers are well. Oh, boy. All coming from a test that doesn't tell if you're sick or not. Then we asked how one knows whether sickness is caused by the virus. Since the test can be positive whether or not you are sick, she replied, you can do a PCR test and find out whether the sick person has the virus. Welcome to the Alice in Wonderland world of virology. Finally, the most revealing quote of all, This one from the chief of infectious diseases at Wake Forest Baptist Health in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. We just don't have enough details yet to make confident statements about immunology. This quote is by an immunologist, and immunologists are the ones deciding public policy. They have put the world under house arrest. It would be nice if they could at least confidently say they knew something about immunology. How did this shocking situation concern tests for viral diseases come about? Let's return to the story of Stefan Lanka, PhD, a virologist from Germany, whom we discussed in Chapter 3. Lanka's work has helped cut through the veils behind which the field of virology is shrouded. As a young graduate student in Germany, Lanka made the chance discovery of the first virus in seawater. Using electron microscopy in his studies of sea algae, he noticed that the algae contained particles. To find out what these particles were, and knowing that no one had described viruses living within healthy algae before, he proceeded as follows. He ground up the algae in a sort of blender, essentially to break apart the walls of the algae. Then he, is it, do people say algae or algae? I don't even know. Doesn't really matter. You know what I'm talking about. He then purified this mixture using the extremely fine filter to separate out particles the size of viruses from everything else. In this way, he obtained a pure solution of water and viruses and anything else that the size of virus or smaller. Then he put this mixture into a density gradient centrifuge, which spins the solution and allows particles to separate out into bands. The final step, use a micropipette to suck out the band that contains only the virus. This simple procedure is a gold standard for purification and isolation of a virus from any tissue or solution. It's not as easy process, but it is not unduly difficult either. He could then study this purified virus under an electron microscope, elucidate its shape and structure, analyze the genome, and ascertain which proteins it contained. With his work, he could confidently state that he discovered a new virus and was sure of its makeup. For this discovery, he received his doctorate and was about to embark on a promising career as a virologist. The only part of Lanka's experiment that surprised him is that in studying the interaction of algae with this new virus, he was forced to come to the conclusion that algae containing the virus were thriving and much healthier than the algae without the virus, which were barely surviving. He may have been the first to come to the conclusion the real viruses in the body of other species are not pathogens, as was at the time, but rather are integral in the healthy functioning of the host. In essence, he was one of the first to propose that in addition to having a microbiome inside us, we also have a virome, and without this virome, we cannot be healthy. This was a radical concept in the 1980s, as no one else had proposed such a theory. If we compare the simple, logical, straightforward way in which Lanka isolated, purified and characterized his virus with a description of how modern virologists propagate viruses now, one begins to see the problem and confusion around testing for viral diseases. When Lanka realized that workers in the field of modern virology were never isolating, purifying, or properly characterizing viruses, but instead confusing what they were finding with artifacts made by their propagation techniques, he naturally questioned whether the viruses that supposedly were caused disease even existed. His question was not too much about whether viruses are infectious entities, but something even more fundamental, whether these viruses even existed at all. Compare Lanka's careful work with how current virologists find and characterize viruses, including the novel coronavirus. They start with sputum from a sick person, having no idea how this person got sick. They centrifuge, but do not filter the sputum. This is not a purification process, as they readily admit in their own papers written about the coronavirus. Here's what the authors of the original papers that found and linked the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, to the disease now called COVID-19 have to say. The following quotations come from a brilliant paper. COVID-19 PCR tests are scientifically meaningless by Torsten Engelbrecht and Konstantin Demeter. Referring to a published image in a paper claiming to have isolated a new virus, they say this image is a virus budding from an infected cell. It is not purified virus. If it's not purified virus, how do the authors know whether it is or not? Is even a virus? What is it, and where does it come from? In the paper, Identification of Coronavirus Isolated from a Patient in Korea with COVID-19, the author stated, "We could not estimate the degree of purification because we did not purify and concentrate the virus cultured in cells." In other words, they did not isolate the virus, even though they claim to do so in the title. That deserved a snort. I'm sorry. Finally, an article, A Novel Coronavirus from Patients with Pneumonia in China, states, "We show an image of sedimented virus particles, not purified ones. The researchers took nasal mucus from sick people, centrifuged it, which is not a purification step, and then showed a fuzzy picture of what they found. They then carried out a genetic analysis of this sediment in order to characterize the novel coronavirus. This piece of fraud was published in the esteemed New England Journal of Medicine." What is the centrifuged material? What is in the centrifuged material that these papers describe? These centrifuged material contains bacteria and perhaps viruses, fungi, human cells, cell debris, and anything else found in the lungs or sinus passages of a sick person. Researchers then inoculate this unpurified mess into a living tissue to make it grow. Sometimes this tissue is lung cancer, sometimes aborted fetal tissue, and sometimes tissue from monkey kidneys. In any case, it is a complex mixture of many components, known and unknown. And then, because this virulent infectious virus won't infect and kill this living tissue unless you starve and poison the tissue first, You deprive the tissue of nutrients and add oxidizing agents to weaken the tissue. Then you add antibiotics to make sure it's not bacteria that is killing the tissue. The tissue from this treatment naturally disintegrates into thousands of components. Then you centrifugist mess again to find out what virus, to find your virus. At that point, you start the PCR testing to determine the genetic and protein makeup of this virus. The protein is that, unlike the clear situation that Lanka encountered, in this splash-dash way, you never have the isolated intact virus as a reference to allow you to know which genetic parts of your unpurified mess actually belong to the virus you are trying to characterize. I'll take a quick break here and get something to drink. 10 seconds. I think it's just another paragraph or so to finish out this segment here. If I could find out where I left off. The tissue from this treatment naturally disintegrates into thousands of components. Then you centrifuge this mess again. As mentioned in Chapter 3, after studying the way in which virologists said they found the measles virus without isolating and purifying it, and actually deciding on the genetic makeup by consensus. Lanka offered a prize of 100,000 euros to anyone who could demonstrate its existence. In the first court to hear the proceedings, the claimant for the prize won the case. The judge concluded that proof of the measles virus did exist. However, the German Supreme Court, with its more stringent rules of evidence and the appointment of a science master to oversee the case, asked that the claimant, in fact, ruled that the claimant did not, in fact, prove the existence of the measles virus. Lanka did not have to pay the claim. However, Lanka's work relevant to the current test used to detect presence of viruses, especially for the coronavirus. Clearly, if one cannot prove that the coronavirus even exists and that the testing for this imagery virus is bogus, then the world has been led wildly astray. If the test for the coronavirus is inaccurate and misleading, as is the case, then there are no grounds for believing the reports about the number of COVID-19 cases, the number of COVID-19 deaths, or even other statistics coming from the orthodox medical institutions. If the testing is bogus, then the coronavirus emperor has no clothes. Let's contrast Lanka's elegant experiments with the test procedures used to determine the alleged presence of coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 infection. Come on. Okay. And don't need to mark my spot this very next page, very start. So I'll take the last break of the show, everybody, and let's see. I think. A couple more short songs. Don't think I played this one yet, so. I guess be back in about 6 minutes, everyone.
Taste of rapture to come.
Okay, and thanks for coming back, everyone. About the last 23 minutes or so. The first thing we need to understand about a PCR test is that it is a surrogate test. It does not find a virus. Rather, it finds something else said to indicate the presence of the virus. A surrogate test is one that is generally easier and less expensive to perform and can stand in for the gold standard test of actually finding the virus and thereby making the clinical practice of medicine easier, safer, and cheaper. Yeah, it's so much easier to so much quicker and easier to swab the nasal passage and pop it in a machine, just like on CSI or something like that, or some kind of a hospital TV show, and claim you have a virus than it is to try to isolate the virus. For example, pulmonary emboli result from blood clots that travel to the lungs. Symptoms include chest pain and shortness of breath. Pulmonary emboli can be fatal. It is important to diagnose the condition early, as it can be treated with blood thinners. It is also important to diagnose accurately, as pulmonary emboli share many symptoms with heart attacks and pneumonia, which calls for different kinds of treatment. Fortunately, there is a test that is 100% reliable for finding pulmonary emboli when performed properly. The procedure, called an angiogram, involves inserting a catheter into the arteries of the lungs. Then the radiologist injects dye into the artery, and dye contains heavy metals that one can see on the X-ray. If a clot is present, the angiogram reliably and accurately demonstrates its presence to the radiologist on the real-time X-ray. With this test, referred to as a gold standard, one can confidently say whether or not the patient has an embolism. Has an embolus. Angiography, however, is technically challenging. It is difficult to find the artery with the catheter. It is costly due to the time and equipment needed. It is dangerous, as the artery may tear during the insertion of the catheter. Another problem with angiography is that it requires injecting heavy metals into the artery and subjecting the patient to a lot of radiation. That's wonderful. As if he doesn't have blood clots already, he's going to get them. Or she. Consequently, medicine has looked for a surrogate test that can more easily and safely detect pulmonary emboli. The VQ scan looks at the blood flow into and through the lungs and compares this with the air movement into the and through the lungs. When all is well with the lungs, these two parameters match up. With an embolus, when an embolus is present, they usually don't match up with blood flow is compromised. This allows the diagnostician to surmise that even though they have not actually seen a clot, it is likely to be present. A surrogate test is one that does not look for what you need to find, but rather for looking for something likely to be there if the condition is present. A surrogate test allows doctors to make an educated guess. To validate a surrogate test, one must first do a careful study in which the surrogate test is compared to the gold standard test. This gives you exact information as to how accurate you can expect the surrogate testing to be. These validating studies are usually carried out at a large medical center or a group of medical centers. The researchers begin to find a large number of patients, say 200, with symptoms typical of pulmonary emboli. For simplicity's sake, let's say that 1,000 do have an embolus, as demonstrated with an angiogram, the gold standard test, whereas the other 1,000 do not. Now we have a group of people who either have or do not have the condition we are testing for. Then we do a VQ scan on each of these 2,000 patients in the group that we know has an embolus. If 900 are positive on the VQ scan, then we know that the surrogate test picks up diagnosis of 90% of the time. In other words, 10% of whatever reason, the surrogate test fails to demonstrate the emboli, even though we know it's there. We now know that a false negative rate is 10%. This allows the clinician to forego the most difficult angiogram because they know how likely the VQ scan will be to pick up the embolus if it is there. They also know that in the event that the test is negative, they still have a 10% chance the test missed it. In that case, they may want to move to the angiogram if the level of suspicion is high that the patient does, in fact, have an embolus in spite of a negative VQ scan. This is basically the art of modern medicine. Why do the second test if you're going to have to do the first test right after it? Doesn't make any sense. Just more money, maybe. I don't know. Likewise, the researchers can then take the 1,000 people who test negative on the angiogram, do the VQ scan on all of them, and determine the false positive rate. If 100 subjects test positive on the VQ scan, even though you might for sure, even though you know for sure they have no clot, then you can accurately and confidently say that for whatever reason, 10% of the time the VQ scan is saying you have a clot when you don't. Again, this helps a clinician who may be confronted with a patient whom he is pretty sure doesn't have a clot. For example, they may have evidence of pneumonia or a heart attack, but orders a VQ scan anyways, just for the money. If the VQ scan is positive, then they may want to confirm this by moving into the angiogram, because it's more money. Because they know that in 10% of the cases, the VQ scan is falsely positive. Clearly, the lower the number of false positives, the false negatives, the better, the more reliable is the test. The point is, without having a gold standard test with which to compare your surrogate test, and without this comparison having been performed in the clearest, most meticulous way possible, there is no possibility of having an accurate surrogate test. To be even clearer, without this, comparison, the surrogate test is completely useless and misleading. Completely. Yet officials are using surrogate COVID-19 tests to send people into nursing homes, remove children from their families, and even separate newborn babies from their mothers if the mother tests positive. Don't go to hospitals to have babies anymore. Have a midwife. They're still around. Don't get vaccinated either. That's the obvious solution. But that's just my. Well, I do have the same doctorate degree that Bill Gates has, so I can confidently give that advice. Yes, I bet it is. As I mentioned, Annie, I do have the same doctor's degree as Bill Gates has, so I should be able to give that advice. The gold standard test for a viral infection is also isolation, purification, and characterization of the virus, as outlined in the description of Lenka's experiment, and the proving of contagion. Lenka didn't prove that the virus he found was contagious simply because it isn't, and no virus is contagious. This is the only possible gold standard there can be. The PTR test examines the pieces of genetic material taken from a swab from the back of the sinus cavity, a very pleasant procedure. No research has shown that this genetic material is unique to that of coronavirus, or even that it comes from a coronavirus. You too, Dr. Mark? Is that your recommendation too? Furthermore, in order to examine this genetic material, the test amplifies it. An amplification cycle means they start with a probe that matches a snippet of DNA and RNA they are looking for, then becomes this is too small to detect. They repeatedly double the snippets. If the sample changes the color of the solution, the test is considered positive. If you do too few amplification cycles, you'll never find the snippet, resulting in a false negative. If you do too many amplification cycles, you find the snippet too often because the test also amplifies the background genetic snippets. There are false positives. He's killing you, Dr. Mark, Melissa. And Dr. Steve. You're killing me, Shorty. One can therefore manipulate the amplification cycles to get whatever result one wants. Too few cycles and everyone tests negative. Too many cycles and everyone tests positive. John Magufuli, president of Tanzania, may be the wisest world ruler alive today. A chemist by training, Magufuli submitted samples to the World Health Organization for testing. Said Magufuli, "We took samples from goats, we sent samples from sheep, we took samples from pawpaws, we took samples from car oil, and we took samples from other different things. We took samples to the laboratory without them knowing." His officials named the samples of car oil. His officials named the sample of car oil Jabil Hamza, 30-year-old male. The results came back negative. They named the sample of jackfruit Sarah Samuel, age 45, female. The results came back inconclusive. Pawpaw got sent in as Elizabeth Ann, 26-year-old female. The poor pawpaw came back positive. Samples from a bird called Kaware and from a goat also tested positive. Rabbit was indeterminate. Sheep was negative. President Magufuli is not wasting any government money on testing for his people. But in the West, governments have gave millions for the PCR test kits. Since no PCR test has ever undergone a comparison with any gold standard, the results are meaningless. This is not a situation where we just need better or more accurate testing. As Kerry Mullisey, a veteran of the PCR technology, has insisted time and again, PCR tests do not prove causation and cannot diagnose illness. The CDC and the FDA concede that the PCR tests cannot be used for diagnosis. A file from March 30, 2020 stated, detection of viral RNA may not indicate the presence of infectious virus, or that 2019 nCoV is a causative agent for clinical symptoms. And this test cannot rule out diseases caused by other bacterial or viral pathogens. Furthermore, the FDA admits that positive results do not rule out bacterial infection or co-infection with other viruses. The agent detected may not be the definitive cause of disease, according to a product announcement for the light mix modular SARS-CoV-2 assays. These assays are not intended for use as an aid in diagnosing of coronavirus infection. One can only wonder what exactly the test is supposed to do if not diagnose a coronavirus infection. The same methodological problems are found with the new antibody tests for assessing immunity to coronavirus. Antibody testing is another type of surrogate testing that does not diagnose illness or contain its cause. A brilliant paper by David Crowe explains in detail the fact that the rhetorical underpinnings of antibody testing have not been demonstrated in any experiment. This is why the Wake Forest immunologists had to admit, we don't know enough about immunology to make any conclusions. Scientists believe that antibodies have the predictable and exact course as they track a viral infection. Antibodies are proteins made by our immune system to either fight off an illness or remember that we have encountered an infectious organism like a virus. At least, this is what we've been told. The theory is that before we encounter a virus or get sick from a virus, we have no antibodies to it. After getting sick, the PCR test should detect the virus, or more accurately, the genetic pieces we think could have come from that virus. Then after 1 week, because viruses and our immune system seems to understand the concept of 1 week, we begin to make antibodies called IgM, which is not specific to this coronavirus, but is made by our immune system to fight off any virus. Then one day 14, as the virus is cleared from your body, the PCR test goes back to negative. The IgM levels go down, and we see the appearance of the more targeted IgG antibody. Then at day 21, because viruses understand that this happens in weekly intervals, the IgM is gone. The antibody test is reliably negative, and the Ig has peaked. The IgG has peaked. At day 28, because our immune system also understands weeks, the IgG levels drop to a level it can't sustain for the long term. Once the test manufacturer or virologist sees the stable IgG level, they supposedly know you are immune for life from the effects of the virus, or maybe not. This theoretical and imaginary construct has many holes big enough that you could drive a truck through them. Consider the following. It turns out that a small percentage actually have IgG. IgM, IgG, or both antibodies months before having the infection. How this is possible, since this is a novel virus that humans have never seen before, is not explained. Finally, studies show that IgG sometimes appears before and sometimes appears after IgM. Sometimes there is no IgM, sometimes there is no IgG. In either case, it may mean you either had the virus or you didn't. And as with AIDS, there is no proof that a particular level of IgG confers immunity. But virologists have an explanation for this. These new wily viruses somehow know how to escape detection and neutralization, even if a person has a robust antibody response. That, of course, is nonsense. Well, it's just kind of like this virus knows that you're standing up or sitting down in a restaurant. And the virus knows that you're 5 feet 11 and a half inches away, and it knows when you're 6 feet away. That's a special, most intelligent virus in the world. Then we're told that a positive PCR test means you are either sick or not sick. Infectious or non-infectious. And then sometimes the test is positive, then negative, then positive, then negative. It's enough to make even the Mad Hatter go silent with disbelief. It absolutely is. And I'm going to end right there for the day, because chapter 6 is the very next page. Most intelligent virus in the world, I'm telling you. So, I think, another short song. Nope, I played that one already. So, this short song here. To end and say thanks for coming out, everyone, and see you tomorrow with me and Roger.
Sing it, Joe. We'll try. You got it.
I love to tell the story of unseen things above, of Jesus and His glory, of Jesus and His love. So long.